future is uncertain. I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain, as free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion, and as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of The Story Behind the Story. I'm your host, Dr. A. Truott, coming to you live tonight from the heart of the Rocky Mountains, the Wasatch Front Range in beautiful and gorgeous Ogden, Utah. Joining me again on the show is, Gully, you've been gone for a few weeks there. James, how you been? James Washington.
I was a little sick. I'm sorry. I'm feeling much better now. And you know what? I went to the doctor and it wasn't COVID. You know what I had?
COVID too?
No, I had the secret. They destroyed my freaking thyroid when they gave me radiation treatment.
Now
they put me on some thyroid pills and wow, I feel like I'm a human being again.
You gotta call my office and get some of my. I'll send you out some potassium and iodine under the tongue, sublingual. If you have problems with your thyroid, that is absolutely important stuff to get it balanced up. Okay, all natural.
I can get that on your webpage, can I?
Sure, but you know, if you call us, we'll give us your address. We'll send it to you free of charge because you're my buddy.
You're a star. I'll send you back my book. I'll sign my book and I'll send it to you.
That's perfect. So yeah, let's get you some minerals going, man. You got to get that going. Kevin, how are you doing? Are you still in the Philippines or?
Sure, I'm. We're just in a holding pattern, getting a visa for my girlfriend, and we're going to be heading out to Albania soon. But I am. Currently over here, it's a beautiful day starting out and a great time to reflect on the week.
That's perfect. Enjoy the beautiful weather over there. I'm jealous. It's starting to warm up here in Utah. It was pushing 60 degrees today, so spring has to be on the way pretty close. When you speak about Albania, remember that I forget what movie it is with Arnold Schwarzenegger where he came dressed up. I think it was it might have been Twins with DeVito. And he said, he dressed up, you know, in shorts and he says, "You look like a goat herder from Albania." And that's what my wife would call me too. When I dress up, sometimes she laughs and says, "You look like a goat herder from Albania." And so watch out for those goat herders when you go to Albania.
I think they'll be friendly ones from what I've heard.
Yeah. Oh my goodness! Well, the goats aren't. I mean, the goats can gore you if you're not too careful. I've had that close encounter myself sometimes. The Albanian goats, they need to have a lot of sure footing to get over those rocky precipices and so forth. Man, you know, I got to tell you guys, I was sent this this link to LT. He's the main interviewer. He didn't really want me to use his full name, but LT is what he goes by. He's an ex-Marine. Well, I shouldn't say ex-Marine, because once you're a Marine, you're always a Marine. So that would be kind of deflating to him. But he was able to do this incredible interview with Laura Logan. I'd heard a little bit about her. I knew she was in Fox Nation, but I don't watch a lot of TV and I don't go into Fox Nation, but I'd heard her, you know, when I was watching the unfolding problem in Afghanistan and then into Iraq. It was interesting that she would be right there. I was impressed with her reporting abilities and all in, you know, in the camo, all in this. And I was wondering if that was all part of an elaborate movie set in Hollywood somewhere. But no, in fact, she put her life on the line. She was what's called embedded into the military, not only into Afghanistan. She was there with the Afghani people, the fighters there, the allies of the U.S. troops. She was embedded with them and was telling her story. It's an amazing interview. Because I say it's amazing for so many reasons, because she is clearly an honest reporter who clawed and scratched her way out of South Africa, where she was born, and spent a lot of time in the bush of Africa. She tells her story so beautifully. I was just amazed at the way and how eloquent she was in her interview with LT. Now, if you don't know, the website is the. I can't give the actual website on a click here, but it's And We Know. Is you just Google an And We Know website. They have quite a presence there on BitChute. I've been subscribed to them for quite a few months. I think they do a fantastic job of interviewing. I think they're very honest and very, very Christian in their beliefs. And it comes, And We Know, is from the scripture that says, and we know that everything that will work out for the best for those who really know and love the Savior. And that's so, so very true and important. So I guys, if that's okay, I would like to just, I got permission to basically, because LT was tied up today. He's actually in the south. He's in your neck of the woods down in offshore. He's an expatriate as well. You know, he's found he could live a little bit higher standard of living, you know, off his military pensions off of the soil of America. And so he's, I understand he's chosen to do that, and that's all well and good, but he is tied in again to a lot of military intel, a lot of, like we have been, and it's like Julian Assange and his anons have been, you know, expatriate military are very important. So he gets along in this interview very, very famously with Ms. Logan, Laura Logan. And I thought, as I listened to this, this is just absolute radio platinum. If to use a term that Alex Tudor always says, oh, this is radio gold. But I think it's a step above that. It's enchanting. She's eloquent in her explanations of her life story. From her career's been up and down, high and low, from being tabbed and getting into the staff of 60 Minutes or CBS and CBS's main war correspondents. Right there in the midst of it. And if she was not blackballed by her conservative stance, I submit she would be right there probably in the middle of the action because she's telling this story exactly what's going on in the Donbass in the eastern area and what Ukraine is really all about these exposing these neo-Nazis, these are occult black art neo-Nazis in charge of this. And And that's a reality, as she exposes so well. So if that's okay, let's just go ahead and before we go into that interview, I just going to want to again say those listening to us maybe for the first time, this radio station and this program has absolutely no commercial interruptions. In fact, we make it very clear we don't promote any product. We simply do it because we're trying to get the truth out and to exercise our First Amendment rights. And that's what it's all about. You may not agree with everything we say and produce here at this show. And just like Kevin and James and their radio shows. I mean, but the important thing is you have the right to say it. You have the right to your opinion and to, again, just declare what you believe. And so that, you know, and the Goldwater Network, thank you again, Kevin, for all that you would do with that. So anything you guys want to add about Laura Logan? You probably have more insight into her than I do.
Well, I've never heard of her.
Okay, well, this will be a first because if you're I hadn't heard that. I heard about her a little bit, but I didn't know the inside story until I listened to this interview.
And I don't mean that bad. It's just
I know.
You know, it's a big world, and I don't know everybody.
Well, she's probably, like I said in the intro, if there's a more decorated as far as awards for the type of journalism she's done, I don't know of anybody that has. She surely is a lot more award-winning than Gunga Dan Rather in CBS. And then putting her life on the line, I mean, in 2011 there in Egypt, in the Egypt Spring, you know, there she was assaulted and gang-raped by 200, you know, angry Egyptian men, okay? She was lucky to survive that. It was an incredible, harrowing experience for her. And this is the type of risk she takes. And then she, because of her conservancy, her stance of being, I think, I submit, honest and truthful, she really has paid the price for that. This is my opinion and looking at her bio and her history and the character assassination she's had to endure over this is pretty doggone amazing. So let's go ahead. Dom has it embedded in the computer. Let's go ahead and we'll just go right to the top of the hour. This is quite it's an hour and 20 minutes total, but everything she says is just an amazing indictment. First of all, on really who runs this country now. And it's only been the last 5 or 6 years, as she explains on her personal blogs, the lies, the misrepresentations of COVID. She even went so far as to call Anthony Fauci worse than Joseph Mengele, and should be absolutely tried and executed. This is the type of things that she's saying publicly now that is so like a breath of fresh air in the world of constant and absolute false reporting, fake news, as Donald Trump would say. So let's go ahead and run the interview, and then we'll just probably take us to the top of the hour, and then we'll finish up and then comment on it in the second hour. That's okay, guys. Okay? Dominique, go ahead and run with us. Here we go. This is Laura Logan with LT of And We Know. Great interview. Okay. Are we...
Started out in South Africa as a print journalist. When I was 17 and still in high school, I pretty much thought that I was going to be, you know, making tea and cleaning up after people. When a veteran journalist said, you know, I went up to her, she came to speak to us at school about the extra parliamentary political activity of women in South Africa who were fighting apartheid. And which was a system of racial division and oppression in South Africa. And she gave me, you know, the opportunity. She was like, well, come by the paper. And, you know, the news editor had a cigarette butt hanging out one side of his mouth, and he had pockmarked skin, and every second word was a curse word, and, you know, a cup of cold coffee in his hand all the time. It was a real, you know, real old school newsroom. When I went there, that was in 1988, I think that was, wow, it seems a long time ago. Anyway, I pretty much just talked my way into every job after that. I volunteered, you know, at a daily newspaper. I said, you got nobody my age on your staff. Let me work for you for nothing. They said, okay, we'll pay you for what we print. And that's what I did until I ended up working for a news agency. And I went to a news agency because veteran journalists told me, you know, the place to get the best news skills, hard news skills, is a Reuters or Associated Press, somewhere like that. You'll never get better experience and you'll never regret your time there. But a journalist told me there's two kinds of people that work at an agency. There's the ones who go there and get experience and move on, you know, and there are those who get trapped. And there you can recognize them because they're the bitter, cynical, overworked ones. And that was pretty much true, although I loved my time there. One day, you know, I was treated poorly by my boss. I slammed the newsroom door so hard. I was hoping the glass would break, but it didn't, unfortunately. And I got on a plane and went to London.
Oh, yep. Wow.
And I went knocking on the door of the networks, ABC, CBS, NBC. And I knew them from, you know, people there from working at a news agency because we provided a lot of the raw material for the networks. And we were the people that worked 7 days a week. We were the people that had to be there in person, always had to show up. We had to anticipate where the stories would be, where to put the crews so that we could capture everything. You couldn't miss anything in that job. And then I loved that.
Right.
I loved being there physically and seeing it and, you know, and being at the source of everything. And I just, you know, I used those contacts. I freelanced in London for a while. I ended up freelancing at CNN for a while. I was, you know, I was working on the news desk, and honestly, it was torture because I was using about 1/100th of my skills, but I had to pay my dues. And I ended up taking a job for a show about environmental issues and living in Siberia for a few months with the Chukchi on a story about whale hunting, doing all kinds of things, kangaroo hunting and the outback in Australia and all that. That was in 1996. Goodness, a long time ago. But what, you know, what I knew I was always going to come back to news. And when I finally got an opportunity to do some work for CNN in their satellites and hosting their CNN World events every year, I did that for them in Africa. Nobody could get a satellite dish in. And they got my name because they said, if there's one person who can get you that dish into that country in time, it's going to be this girl, right? Because I was a girl at that time, I guess. And I did. I pulled it off. And when they said, you know, thank you for what you did, job well done, great, I said, all right, you take 2 minutes. Give me 2 minutes. Thank me in person. And I flew to Atlanta. That's how I got a meeting. And, you know, I ended up working at CNN. And that was really hard for me. I was very poorly treated. Everybody you worked with, your cameraman, your producer, everyone wanted to be a correspondent and hated you for existing. And, I was ridiculed and treated like, oh, Barbie goes to war, right? They didn't know I grew up in Africa. You know what I mean? Like we went to, my parents took us to places that had no electricity for vacation, right?
Wow.
And I would go into the African bush, with a backpack and a friend of mine, who was, a ranger. And we would go and sleep next to a river in the night and take turns every 2 hours doing night watch, dig as deep as you could. Even though the water was black, you knew it was clean enough. You know, I did that stuff for fun, right? Mm. I loved it. I loved to be close to the earth and know what it's like not to have electricity and running water and all of those things. I mean, it's like, you know, I remember coming back home and looking at the light switch, thinking about that, what it meant. And thinking about all the people up the road in the townships, you know, the all the black people that didn't have electricity ever at home.
Right.
And I think those things were really important, you know, because I knew who I was and nobody could take that from me always. But at the same time, I was like, wow, this is not for me. The person you have to become to succeed in this environment is really not a person I want to be. I have no desire to become that. So I'm never going to be. I'm never really going to fit here. And I was disparaged for the amount of detail that I cared about in the stories and all of that, you know. And I was very poorly treated, but I was grateful that I had an opportunity. You know, it still meant something, and it was the school of hard knocks. So I didn't mind it from that point of view, but I decided to be, I was offered a job with an aid agency, and I thought, okay, maybe that's what I need to do. Well, a year of that cured me for life. I knew I was always meant to be a journalist. And while I was doing, working for this organization, I continued to write. I wrote for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which was a fabulous paper. Mm. And, they were very good to me there. Loved, Michael Ruby, the editor. And I continued to report for other people. I just would, you know, if I was somewhere where a story was happening, I would report for free. I would call the South African Broadcasting Corporation and say, hey, I'm a South African and I'm here and this is a big story. Don't you want to report? They would say, okay. And they would let me do it and I wouldn't get paid or anything. It didn't matter because what mattered was to tell the story. I wanted people to know, wanted them to see what I was seeing and to understand. And I wanted to have them to have access to that, whether they had the money to pay to send a team or not.
Right.
So, and I wasn't earning a lot of money. It wasn't ever about the money for me. So, you know, how did I end up at 60 Minutes after doing that? Well, I went and interviewed for my first job. I was in my 30s. I'd never interviewed for a job before. I just walked into their offices and said, this is why you need to hire me. Or I was, you know, or I was where you needed to be. And I sucked. Man, that interview was a humiliation. They asked me, I remember they asked me who I liked of their anchors and reporters. And I had never actually watched that show. I'd never watched their program. And I had to admit that, right? And they hired me anyway. I mean, I couldn't believe it. That was a shock. But what a great thing that turned out to be for me, because that was GMTV, a morning channel in the UK. And they had great people there, newsmen, real newsmen,
right,
who wanted to be a serious news channel or wanted to do serious news, actually is a better way to put it. And they recognized what I had to offer and they just let me do it. And of course I ended up in Afghanistan for them on my own. I remember I'd been living in Afghanistan with the Afghan soldiers. This is right after 9/11. I'd been there for months at that point. And I remember the news editor saying to me, I found out from somebody else that another team had gotten visas. And I called him and I said, why do these people have visas? And he said, well, you know, he's blustering his way through because they're busted, right? They didn't tell me that of course, from their point of view, they're going to get another team visa. But I said to him, you realize I have been taking care of these soldiers for months now, right? I mean, they think I'm like Dr. Jane Medicine Woman. They get a headache, I got tablets. they have a bite or a cut and I can help them.
Right.
And you spend every minute of the day and night with these guys, right?
That's right.
And there's no, you know, they fire up the ovens to make bread every couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And within a few days, that bread is like a murder weapon. And so you're living in, and there's loyalty. Afghans are amazingly, extraordinarily loyal people. And believe me, I didn't love everything about them at the time. I mean, the guys would sit around me when I was doing my reports and, you know, they would get in, you'd start with one and then it would be two and then it would be 10 and 20. I'd have like 200 of them and it'd be hot, you know, and stinky and nobody spoke English and they're staring at you and they're laughing at you or they're, you know, talking about you and you'd be like, what do you want? You are annoying. Get back. But I, you know, in the fires of hell, I forged such an extraordinary bond in the end. I learned to understand Afghan people who are very different people and learned to appreciate them for who they were.
Right.
And I said to my news editor, you realize if you send another team in here, I'm going to have their chopper shot down, right? Because I can talk to these guys. They'll do anything for me. And he roared with laughter. Of course, no one really wanted to come in because I was living on the front line.
Right.
And I was alone and I had nothing. I didn't even know how they were going to get there. Steve Harrigan from Fox was the only other journalist living on the front line. And I remember I was about to go live one day and he comes by the mud place where I was living. And he says to me, I'm trying to figure this out. You've got $2,000 of mine. You have my satellite phone it was the battery. Mine wasn't working. I'd stolen his battery. And you have my cameraman. He said, and I don't like people and I don't help people. How did this happen? So anyway, when I was working, when being there in Afghanistan, on the front line reporting like that, that was what really opened a lot of doors for me. And I was offered, you know, a really great deal at the BBC, and I was offered a job at NBC, but it was 60 Minutes and Jeff Fager that really, my agent was like, I know we're about to sign, but if it was anyone other than 60 Minutes, I wouldn't be making this call. And that began my journey at 60 Minutes. I was so tired of meeting people and all the rest of it. By the time I got the interview, I just walked into Jeff Fager's office and chilled on the couch, and we talked journalism. It's what we talked. Wow. And, you know, many years later, those really nasty people at Media Matters and all of their little, you know, puppets that they have sprinkled around the media, they tried to make out, they did a hit piece on me, Benghazi and the Bombshell, and they tried to make out like there was something sexual or physical in the relationship I had. And nothing could have been further from the truth, actually. Mm-hmm. Nothing could have been further from the truth. And these people are evil. They just savage everything they can because they don't care, right? And that same article tried to rewrite my history by saying that I was groped when I was attacked in Egypt working for 60 Minutes, and I wasn't, you know, when I was really gang raped and sodomized and beaten almost to death. So that tells you a lot about that journalist, right? Mm-hmm. Joe Hagan tells you a lot about him. Mm-hmm. So I don't worry about those people now, but honestly, just telling you that story just reminds me that that thing that bound me to my boss at 60 Minutes was that gene of that real journalist gene. That's all we did. We talked stories and news. I didn't try to sell myself, and he didn't ask me to.
And so you end up there, and I wanted to play something. You know, we've heard a lot about, we're going to get into Ukraine in a moment if you've got some great information there. I'm interested, and I know if I'm really interested in who you are and where you've come from and how you ended up where you're at, especially as a journalist, I go out and do some research and find out that you've got an Emmy, right? And so I went out and found this clip, and I believe the year's 2008. Am I right on that one?
Let me think about that. Maybe 2000. No, it's not 2008. That's the year I had my son. That was definitely before. And, you know, it's funny that you say an Emmy, because Wikipedia insists on making it an Emmy.
Yep.
And I have like 12, 13, maybe 14 Emmys, which, you know, it is what it is. It doesn't matter anymore because, you know, they give Emmys for things like Russia collusion these days, stories that didn't even happen. So it doesn't matter, but I always think it's funny every time someone introduces me. I know when they've gone to Wikipedia because they say she's the recipient of an Emmy.
Yeah, but you've got more than that. I'm going to play this clip real quick just so folks that are interested, and I'm putting it in the description box below for those that want to see it also, okay, just for a moment.
And the Emmy goes to CBS Evening News, Ramadi on the front line.
As the Marines start to head out, they pass these Iraqi men who they believe must know if an attack is coming, but they offer no warning. On the final approach to the base, they find the shopkeepers have fled, their goods still on display. Then it begins. Out of nowhere, the first shot slams into a Marine. Thank you very much to everybody who's here tonight and to the Emmys. I think Jeff and I both feel, we talked about this before, and if we were to win it, we wanted you to know that this award does not belong to us. It belongs to the Marines that fought for 3.5 years in Ramadi to hold one strip of road and never went anywhere. And if you were to take a map of Iraq before the battle for Baghdad began, more American blood is soaked into the earth around Ramadi than any other place in the country. And when we went to cover this story, just Jeff and I, he wasn't actually working for CBS Evening News, he was working for 60 Minutes. And nobody knew what we were going to do, nobody assigned us, nobody sent us. In fact, after about 2.5 weeks of radio silence, I was in a fair amount of trouble when I finally called in. But I believed in covering this story because day after day we would sit in Baghdad and get press releases about the deaths of American Marines and soldiers in Ramadi and have no way to show what they were living through. And a lot is known about how this war is covered, and in a short news piece, you never get to say everything. But I want to leave you with one image of what our time in Ramadi was like. When we went there, the whole city was awash with sewage. There was nothing left of the infrastructure. We waded through sewage every day, sometimes literally up to our waists. We had no water to wash or food to eat, and those are the conditions in which the Marines are working every single day. It was so dangerous that the army refused to supply them downtown. So most of them lived on what they had sent over from home, from their families and from their friends. And Jeff and I were in the kitchen the one day with the Marines. We were talking, and one of them threw away a few pieces of moldy bread, and another kid got up from the table and went and picked the bread out of the trash and said, "Don't do that, man. We can still eat this." And that is not something that most of the United States of America understand about how the U.S. military sometimes has to fight this war. When I came back from Ramadi to edit these pieces in New York, I just looked around me like I was on an alien planet, because there's no way you can ever explain what it's really like for the guys that are fighting it. No matter what you think about the war, the suffering on all sides is really a terrible thing to see. Thank you very much.
Now, Laura, that was very inspiring. And I see you there, you know, all dressed up and giving the speech, and then, you know, there's a stark contrast wearing all of this gear and then talking about the Marines. And, boy, that hits a chord with me, because I've been with journalists on the front lines as a Marine public affairs officer, and I got to tell you, the way that you just described that really struck a chord with me, hits pretty hard at the heart. But anyway, I'm just glad that we have that clip to share with everyone, because I really think it's important. I want to understand what drives you. Why do you have so much passion when you're speaking and when you're on TV shows, or before you got kicked off, obviously, of Fox, but some other things. But you just seem to have a drive about you, and I'm just interested in why do you have such a drive? What's going on? What makes you tick?
I don't know. It's just always been that way. Yeah. I was born that way. I mean, you know, I don't think I've ever watched that clip, you know, since that night. And that was, you know, that was a lot of years ago now. And it's really interesting to me, because I didn't write a speech. Mm-hmm. I didn't rehearse anything. I didn't know if we were going to win, and I didn't know what I was going to say. As I said, Jeff Newton, yep. One of my best friends in the whole world, and also the cameraman and producer on that. Jeff and I had agreed we would give it to the Marines, because it kind of feels wrong to take an award for something like that when it's really them and their story that's being honored to us, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I shot some of that myself, because it was only two of us, and I used to get frustrated, right? Your cameraman is only able to do so much than one person, and so I used to carry a camera a lot of the time and film a lot myself too. And I was really proud of that story, because every word I said there was absolutely true, right? Nobody sends you. You've got to make those stories happen. You've got to find a way to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot for them. The Marines didn't want journalists there. They right. want a whole bunch. I mean, I think Dexter Filkins, in his book, The Forever War, yeah. he wrote that the worst place to be on the battlefield in an embed was to follow a Lara Logan embed, because you had to listen to the Marines talking. They're like, "Oh, you're not as good looking as the last reporter we had here."
Oh my goodness!
Because he's a guy, right? You know right. what Marines are like.
Yeah, yeah.
I always remember that being funny. Somebody called me. I think it was Jeff. And he said, "I'm sending you this book."
Right. Now, real quick, could you explain to the audience, those that might not understand, what an embed is? They might interpret that a little different. What does that mean? I know what it means, but I'll let you talk.
Yeah, I mean, all it means is, right, when reporters go and spend time with the military, so you're embedded with him. And it became kind of controversial because people like to attack embedded reporters are not honest. And, you know, it was really kind of ridiculous because they say, well, I've been living in Baghdad for five years, embedded with the Iraqi people. You know, nobody accuses me of being biased because of that. What they understand that means is that you've spent time there. You've learned about the culture. You've learned about the place. You've learned about the people. Yeah, you become something of a beat reporter. And I always thought that it was important to spend time with people, especially something like the military. I didn't understand anything going into it. I didn't know, you know, I mean, you go out with the commander and I'm wandering off everywhere doing whatever I do as a reporter, nosing around and all the rest of it. And I don't understand what I'm doing to the PSD, right? I mean, to the general, the colonel, the whatever it happens to be, the captain, security detail. Is now I'm pulling them out of their positions because instead of worrying about the principal person they have to keep alive, they're now worrying about keeping me alive. And it's little things like that. You know, all I wanted to do was bridge the gap of understanding so that when I was on a battlefield, I understood, you know, the TTPs, the tactics, the techniques and the procedures, the maneuvers. I knew, I felt like it was a language that I had to learn to offer anything meaningful when you're on that battlefield and to understand who are these people, you know, who are these people in uniform and learn the difference between an NCO and an officer and, you know, and so on, right? And so, you know, to go back to your original question, which I haven't answered properly yet, why do I do it? Well, it's like asking a chair why you're a chair. You just are. That's who I am. I was born this way. It's what I breathe. It's what I live. I want to understand. And I don't know how to understand without being there, without talking to people, without living it, without experiencing it, without seeing it, without smelling it. You know, that's what I always wanted to do. That's why I lived in Baghdad for 5 years. That's why I went over and over back to Afghanistan. I lived in Afghanistan for a year and I went back, you know, many times. I lived there for months at a time. In addition to that, I lived with the Palestinians. I lived with the Israelis. You know, I did all of those things because I wanted more than a superficial understanding. And it follows that, you know, you really need to spend time, getting to know people and know situations and know places. And it's been really important for me actually, because being in the U.S., you know, once I got further up the chain, you know, I would be told with some disdain by my bosses, you know, you're a 60 minutes correspondent now. You can't just go off to Afghanistan for 2 months. Or you're the chief foreign correspondent now. You know, you have other responsibilities and you've got to let, the number of times I've heard people say to me, you've got to let go of this and you've got to do it this way. And of course there's some wisdom to that. But there is also no substitute for learning it yourself. And so I've tried really hard to take account of that and to listen. I always try to be very self-critical and try to be honest with myself. And so, you know, listen to what people are saying. And yet then at the same time, stay true to what I know. I know when my gut is right. So when you hear, you know, now you're in Washington and you go to these think tanks and, you know, these famous think tanks, or you go to a White House briefing or an intelligence briefing or, you know, and so on and so on. And I hear people saying things like, well, you know, Afghanistan isn't really a country anyway, you know, and Afghans are better off if they just break up and, you know, or, you know, similar things about Iraq. And I'm like, wait a minute, hold on a second. No, that's not true. Afghans, yes, they're very loyal to their tribe. Yes, they're very independent, but nobody says because the state of Texas is very proud of being the state of Texas that you can't be a Texan, a proud Texan and an American.
That's right.
Nobody says that, right?
That's right.
They don't do that. So why does it have to be a choice in Afghanistan? It doesn't have to be a choice. And if you know any Afghan, they're fiercely nationalistic, right? They're very proud of being Afghan. So that's not true at all. So when someone at a think tank or, you know, somebody else is proposing that as a solution, I can call, you know, BS on that, right? Because I know it's not how Afghans feel. And so I think that that kind of intimate knowledge, that knowledge of your beat as a reporter is yep. very important to not being deceived and not being lied to.
That's
they
right.
want the reporter that's who's there for 5 seconds because mm-hmm. that's the reporter who's going to buy all their talking points.
Right.
You know, I wasn't that reporter. In fact, many commanders did not want me around. And it's funny because, of course, the political operatives masquerading as journalists and the big hit machine, the smear doctors, right? The assassins, the character assassins, they always try to paint me as the darling of the military. And it was hilarious because General Eikenberry, I mean, he stormed out of my interview with him mm-hmm. before I even got started. He thought he would do a little warm up chat and sort of put me in my place and, you know, steer me the direction he wanted.
Right.
And that did not happen. So he took up his microphone and walked out mm-hmm. and quit. And yeah. then he assigned a full bird colonel to shadow me everywhere I went after
right.
that. And, you know,
right.
years later, when I did another embed, I mean, and they were freaking out about everything I did. One of them even said to me, they've never forgotten Eikenberry. You know, they've never forgotten that trip. And it was like, it was literally when I asked him about, I said, well, we also want to talk about Pakistan. And guess what? You know, the only thing you really needed to talk about was Pakistan from day one until now.
Right.
And that was when Eikenberry, you know, walked out and his PAO said to me, well, you know, you're wanting to go into, you know, political places. The general just can't go there. And I'm like, really? Because he talked to Carl Ottagold in the New York Times yesterday about mm-hmm. Pakistan. Here's
right.
the article.
Right.
Right? I mean,
yeah,
come
there's
on.
There's a lot that goes on in that world. A lot of that
yeah.
world in these
General Barno.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went and did an interview with him. I didn't even get to the hard question. And he was like, I just said the word Pakistan because I'd just been blown up on the Pakistani border. Jeff and I had on a totally different trip. We had, the vehicle had gone over a landmine. And so we'd been, you know, tossed in the air, up armor, right? No armor. That was the days before armored vehicles. 2003,
wow.
23rd of November, 2003. Like, you know, 11, 12 soldiers in the back, two in the front, open cargo, right?
Right.
And we hit a double anti-tank mine. Boom. Right. The guy next to me, Sergeant Roy Mitchell, lost his leg. And Sergeant Michael Eichner broke his back. And so, you know, what I like to do is I like to go and spend time on the battlefield. I mm-hmm. like to spend time on the story. And the last thing I would do is talk to the general because I understood once you hit 3-star and above, you're a political appointee. Right. So you're the guy that I can ask the political questions to. You're the guy I can ask about strategy. You're the guy who's responsible for all of this, and mm-hmm. you're politically trained.
Yep.
So you can't tell me, oh, I'm sorry, ma'am, that's out of my lane. I can't talk about that.
Right.
And
right.
by the way, at the same time, I never asked a lower-ranking soldier or Marine those kind of questions once I learned what they're responsible for and what they can affect, right?
Right.
Because it's not fair. It's not fair to put them in that position. And
mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to get one over on someone.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get I'm trying to get to the truth.
Right.
So I don't want to do that. Why would I do that?
Right.
I'm going to take some private and I'm going to ask him a question like that.
Mm-hmm.
Why? You know, that just seemed dishonest to me, fundamentally dishonest and unfair. So, you know, with General Barno, I asked him about Pakistan and he starts going on about, I can't talk about Pakistan. Well, I mean, you know, it went downhill from there, right? That's one of my first 60-minute stories, and I still love that piece. And he actually requested an interview with me before on his way out, an exit interview on his way out of the country, because he said the first time he thought he was going up against whatever the Atlanta football team is, the college football team, and he said instead he got the Atlanta Falcons. So he wanted another go-around, which is kind of funny. Sorry, I interrupted you, LT.
No.
What were you going to say?
No, we're fine. I just wanted to that's a perfect segue into what's been happening with you recently. You go out, you grab the information, you're making sure that it's accurate and the best that you can, and you've built the case with your foundation and your life. You've got what it takes to get it right. And so, you know, you pull up the Yahoo Entertainment, the Wrap, and they put out Russian officials endorse Lara Logan's comments linking Ukrainian soldiers to Nazis and occultism. Do you see this article? Yeah.
I don't read this stuff.
Yeah, of
it's
course.
Funny.
Right, right.
It's
and
funny.
So of course they put out this information, you know, that you're being endorsed, and of course they remind everybody that you were comparing Dr. Anthony Fauci to Nazi war criminal Josef Mengele, right? Yeah.
I'm glad they're reminding everyone.
That's right.
And so when all the information comes out, everybody's going to say I was right.
Yeah.
And actually, it wasn't me making the comparison. It was doctors, doctor after doctor after doctor, and many other people. Most people agree with that.
That's right. That's right. And so then, of course, at the bottom of the article, according to reporting from Newsweek, far-right and even neo-Nazi elements are present within some Ukrainian military forces, but analysts have also condemned Russian President Vladimir Putin's propaganda that the invasion is a special military operation attempt to denazify the country.
Mm. Yeah, sure. So basically they're trying to make me out to be some kind of stooge of the Nazi. I mean, of the Russians, right?
Right.
Like I'm some kind of Russian propagandist. They can say whatever they like because, it's just what they're saying is not true. Look at that. Yeah, there's the Azov battalion that's funded by the U.S. and NATO, proudly holding up their NATO flag and the swastika. Mm-hmm. I always want to imagine one unit, never mind a battalion. How about a unit in the United States military holds up their crest because that's what that is in the middle, the Azov battalion's insignia. Yeah. And the swastika at the same time. And someone says, it doesn't matter. There aren't a lot of them. Oh. Even though that's a lie in itself, right? I mean, it's ridiculous. How big was the Einsatzgruppen? Those were Hitler's extermination squads, right?
Right.
Those were his hitmen that used to go and make sure that every last Jew was killed.
Hmm.
They weren't many. They didn't need to be many. Because what these guys do, you know, I mean, they shoot protesters, civilian protesters, as they're climbing out of burning buildings. That's the kind of thing Ukraine's neo-Nazi paramilitaries do.
Yeah. And so I played this clip yesterday as you're talking about it. Excuse me. And you've got this guy on top of a roof in a residential building.
Yeah.
You see what he's doing? Mm-hmm. He's got the weapons. I don't know if you've seen that clip. And there he is located right there, and there's a playground. So you got all this evidence that's flying in just for us to look at, and you're wondering what in the world's going on over there. Why are they using – look at this. You see all of these military guys. They're located in the place where the families are located.
And these are Ukrainian military.
Correct.
These are not Russian military.
Correct. Yep. And I played the video clip of the of them. You know, if you look at these clips that come in, I don't know if you saw this one, but she's basically – I believe the principal of the kindergarten school. There's two schools. Get the howitzers out of here and put them in the fields.
Yep.
You know, and so she's just begging them, like, get out of here. And these guys are, you know, screaming at them and whatever. And this is the director of the kindergarten, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, get out of here. You're leaking our coordinates. Blah, blah. Yeah, your coordinates, they're here at the kindergarten. How about putting them out in the field? And so this is the kind of stuff that we're seeing, right? And you're pointing it out in all of the interviews that I've seen on different channels, and I just think it's amazing as you put this information out. I just felt it was really important for everybody to understand you're not just somebody that's gathering information, putting it out. You have a drive about you, and there's a reason you have a drive. You've been reporting from the front lines. You've experienced these things. You've seen this up front. But we're not seeing this type of reporting now. What we're getting is we're getting clips from other countries from 2 to 3 years ago, and they're claiming that it's happening in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of reporting is going on now? Because obviously the reporting you were doing, you were actually there. It was actually happening. Folks were getting shot right in front of you. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. Of course. And many times, many, many times. You know, it's extraordinary. Just think about this for a second, LT. The very people that are criticizing people like me and trying to paint us as Russian stooges and propagandists because they supposedly care about the people of Ukraine, they are the ones not listening to the people of Ukraine, right? Mm-hmm. There you have the director of the kindergarten, and she's not the only one. I've seen other eyewitness interviews with other people, another woman in a village saying, you know, the Russians were not firing. The Ukrainian military was firing on our village. The Russians didn't fire back. It was you. It was you, our own military, firing on us. And, you know, supposedly these people, you know, they present themselves, all these journalists and leaders and everything, as we're the ones who care about the people of Ukraine. But if you cared about the people of Ukraine, why would you not listen to them? and not just the ones that reinforce your narrative. Why wouldn't you listen to all the people? And this is a real, I mean, this is a real characteristic of journalism today. Mm. Look at the southern border. You hear one story and one story only. It's the story of the people coming here to make a better life and their tragic journey. You never hear the story about, let me see, for example, Nigerians coming out of Nigeria being trafficked by, these people in Libya, human traffickers in Libya, who are taking the organs of Nigerian refugees and torturing them to death. It's not hard to find this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It's all over Facebook. You can see the survivors standing there with scars from here down where they've been ripped open and their organs sold. But no, we don't want to tell that refugee or immigration story, right? Because here, even though you have a black victim, they're Africans. We don't care really about Africans, right? We only care about black people when it suits us. And then at the same time, wait a minute, the traffickers are Arabs and they're Libyans. And, we've only got one narrative on Libya. And we don't want to show, this is Muslim people doing this to black people. No, because racism has to be defined as white supremacy, right? It's only something evil that the evil white people, particularly in America, do to black people. And mm-hmm. these are false narratives. They're just not true. So, right. Okay, wait, now you got me fired up.
Yep.
Now you have me fired up because now you're speaking to what motivates me.
Yep. Come on, bring it.
What motivates me is I want the truth, and I want people to understand the truth. We all deserve the truth. I had cancer when I was 41 years old. I would have died if the doctor lied to me. That's not his job. He didn't want to tell me. I'm sorry, Laura. I'm sorry. I hate to tell you this. Because he delivered my babies. Mm-hmm. You know, he wanted to be the one. Could have been the oncologist. Could have been the clinic that did the test. He said to me, I wanted to call you myself. Right? They offered to call you, but I wanted to call you myself. I wanted you to know. I'm sorry, but you have cancer. I was 41 years old. My daughter was one. My son was two. My stepdaughter, just a couple years older than that. And that's what being... Well, that's what having real integrity and courage is about, right? It's about saying, I'm going to tell you the truth, whether you like it or not, because I'm going to give you the best shot that anybody has at surviving this or fixing this or making it right or making a good decision. I explained to soldiers when I would go, when I would be embedded, I would have robust arguments with them, right? And I always knew the ones that had real that knew who they were and had moral courage because they were grateful that I didn't lie to them. Mm-hmm. And I used to say to them, you know what? They say, if you're going to get it right, don't print a whole bunch of lies about us like the rest of the media. And I say, you know what? Let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to get it right because I owe you that. That's my responsibility and that's my duty. But I can't get it right if you don't help me, right? But guess what I'm not going to do? I'm not going to only be responsible to you. You're here in another country. You're here in a village. You're showing me the wells that you've built. Well, how many people in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever it happens to be, how many people have access to clean drinking water?
Hmm.
Do you know? No, you don't know. Guess what? When I put that in a context, what is that going to show? What's it going to look like then? Right. And how many people have access to clean drinking water before you came in here? And how many have access to it now? Has that needle shifted? Have you made life better for people in the long run? And you're showing me all these people you've given jobs to. How long are they going to be employed for? Are they going to have jobs for a couple of months and then they're going to go back to being unemployed? And what's going to happen when you pull out of here? So I would explain it to them in the sense that I have a responsibility to you, but I don't only work for you. I have a responsibility to these people in this village and in this country to put this in a broader context. I have responsibility to the audience at home because they got to make a decision about this. They got to vote on this. They got to know what to say, what to do, and to do that, to make good decisions, they need real information and they need the truth. And then you've got people running for office. They don't need to be lied to. They don't need to be backing the wrong people or making the wrong decisions or voting the wrong way because they were lied to. They need to know. And then, by the way, there's all your families at home. Right. And there's all the people who are going to give up their sons and their daughters and their brothers and sisters and their mother and father. I have responsibilities to them, too. And, I'm not a PR person for the United States military. That's not my job. And most soldiers appreciated that. You know, they appreciated the honesty. Sometimes they would say, because they would ask me questions about what was happening in the rest of the country. They didn't know. You know, you know what it's like.
Yep.
Okay, Marine, this is your patch of dirt, right?
Yep.
This is what you're responsible. Stay in your lane.
That's
okay,
right.
And so you stay in your lane. And you know, but they wanted to know. And they were curious. And they wanted the truth. And the ones who didn't like it very much, I didn't worry about them.
Yep.
You know, sometimes they blocked me from coming back. And I had to find another way. Or sometimes, you know, I had to go around them. Or if I could, if I got lucky and knew someone I'd been around for so long, knew someone above them, you know, and figured a way out. And sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I banged my head against a wall for 6 months and went nowhere. And that was okay, too. I accepted that as the price of doing business.
Virginia Tech swimmer competing in this year's NCAA championship details how her teammate was brought to tears after her place in the finals, right? You've been watching this.
Mm-hmm.
And Twitter's banning reporters. They've interviewed the swimmers to find out what's going on with this, you know, guy that wants to compete in girls' sports.
Yeah.
And we've got, you know, that happening. You've got the media covering up the laptop issue. You know, even Joe Rogan, mm-hmm. I've said this many times on my, a lot of my videos that sometimes I'm leery of where these guys come from because I wonder in the media world or the controlled world of who's bought out and
mm-hmm.
who's not bought out and whatever. Why would all of a sudden Joe Rogan start sharing, in my opinion, to millions of people, truth bombs? And so I'll play this real quick clip.
Not that I'm a Trump supporter. I didn't vote for him. I didn't vote for any Republican ever in my life. But you're looking at something that's real information and you're hiding it from people because you don't like the result that you think is going to come out of that information. That's not how we're supposed to be doing things.
Yeah. Just simple. He's just common sense. He's just a podcaster. He's just a guy sitting there with a microphone and an audience. And he's baffled, right? And I'm just shocked that he's allowed to even talk about that. And I don't know if you saw that Candace Owens was, you know, New York Times reaches out. You're advancing ideas that Ukraine is a corrupt country, similar to Russian state TV. What does she reply back with? I replied to her, and then I actually got my ideas from the New York Times. And then she provided the links to their articles where they stated Ukraine's unyielding corruption. So she educated herself using the New York Times attack.
I was muted and didn't know it myself, but we're
listening to Revolution Radio, Freedom Flips.
We'll be right back.
We'll be right back after this message.
Story behind the story. Dr. H. Ruoff.
Como va? This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect Triangle. Live. Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The perfect triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio Studio A for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle, with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, the Cosmic Oracle here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Hi, everybody. It's me, the Fetch, host of Inside the Eye Live. Before the Sunday mainstream media, political pundit talk shows, there is Inside the Eye Live, where we break down some of the weekly mainstream media talking points before the talking points even get aired. Add in some entertaining stories, weather, cats, intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
Alright, let's show them what we got here.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you got to listen to the doctor. Yes, this is like first hour. We're just going over this incredible interview with LT, who's the main reporter for And We Know AWK. Yeah, just an amazing story of perseverance. Laura Logan started out again just with a drive and desire to tell the truth, to tell a story, to get the word out. And, you know, facing bullets, you know, getting blown up with a troop carrier, not being killed, it was quite amazing when she witnessed Marines next to her and others, you know, losing limbs and parts of their bodies. It's amazing to realize that she's been there and has been on the front lines. Now we see what's going on, and she's deeply concerned. You can't help but admire her pluck as she tries to tell the story of what she really knows to be true, and not just sitting there and just letting people, you know, just tell lies. There's another clip that I sent out earlier where she's actually being interviewed by, looks like what is a Fox affiliate station somewhere in the country, and they're of course just stunned, the talking heads, the anchors, the gentleman and a very, you know, attractive, I call her a bimbo blonde, just because she's eye candy sitting there looking like well, this is not what we expected. This is not the story. She's not telling us how evil these Russians are. In fact, she's going, really going on in depth about how evil the Ukrainian Nazis really are. And I just was fun to watch as she's doing her rant, her honest journalism in the face of yellow journalism, seeing they're just wondering how in the world can we shut her up? This is what we expected. It's quite amazing to see that. At least that's my opinion of the interview. But we'll go ahead and finish up with her, and we'll get some take on it from our other hosts and get their opinion of Laura Logan. So let's go ahead and continue. Go finish up. She's got about another half
talk
hour.
About
so.
That. I don't know if you saw that Candace Owens was, you know, New York Times reaches out. You're advancing ideas that Ukraine is a corrupt country, similar to Russian state TV. What does she reply back with? I replied, and then I actually got my ideas from the New York Times. And then she provided the links to their articles where they state Ukraine's unyielding corruption. So she educated herself using the New York Times, who attack her, stating she's doing what they're actually putting out as information. I mean, that was brilliant. That's brilliant. And so what we're not seeing, you know, RT's taken down. You saw this right here, the video of the Russians. Supposedly they're bringing food to the Ukrainian people.
Yeah. And now they want us not to see that. Why? Why do they want us not to see that? You know, what else do they want us not to see? What else is a lie in the narrative? Okay, so this is another thing that just makes my blood boil, right? It makes me so angry because look how we're being deceived. I mean, I literally had someone say to me this weekend, oh, but, you know, but Putin is just a, you know, a terrible guy. If you think that Zelensky's a bad guy, you know, and he deserves to go, then you got to believe that Putin's a bad guy and he deserves to go. It's not about that. It's about what is the truth right now? Is Putin doing what they say he's doing? It's not about whether or not he's a good guy. Is Zelensky really the hero of the moment? Oh, wait a minute. Did Zelensky preside over the murder of how many thousands of people of Ukraine? Russian-speaking Ukrainians who were murdered in Donbas and Odessa and Lugansk. The east of the country is littered with mass graves. And guess what? You don't even have to look very hard to find the evidence of that. You can see the bodies being exhumed. There are documentaries that have been made. George Eliason is an American journalist who has spent years in Ukraine. I have been speaking to George for years, right? And this poor man, I mean, he's earned almost nothing. He's been savaged and attacked just like the rest of us. He's been falsely targeted and smeared. And he stood his ground because he's been to the mass graves, right? Mm. He's seen it. He's the guy on the ground where if I didn't have children, that's where I would be. I would be bringing you that evidence. I would be showing it to you. I would be doing it with every single bit of my body. I would be doing my best to show you the whole truth, not just one narrow slice of it, not just, you know, a little piece of it that serves a particular narrative, right? I mean, we want to talk about families crossing the southern border, but we can't talk about national security. You know, we can't talk about that. No, we got to pretend that when you open a border, it's only good things that happen. Only good people that come across, the bad people, the bad things. That doesn't happen. Not allowed to talk about that. And then you're a bad person. You're a racist. You know, and now the same thing with Ukraine. That do people actually realize that when they start talking about World War III, when they start talking about nuclear attacks and EMPs and all this kind of thing, that when they start censoring you and hiding the truth, it's because they're bringing that to your door. That's what they're trying to do. They're projecting their actions, just like they always have, accusing people of January 6th of a seditious conspiracy, when they're the ones who have had a real conspiracy, where they have conspired with each other, and they're guilty of sedition, treason and sedition, right? Which is the statute. When they talk about, Donald Trump isn't going to accept the election results, and they shake that whole operation. You know, the ballots when they're being counted, the real ballots that were cast, you know, Trump's going to be way ahead. But the moment those mail-in ballots come in, you know, Biden's going to win it, right? What are they doing? Projecting and shaping the information environment, preparing you for what they're going to do. We've seen this over and over and over again. And mm-hmm. anybody who knows about strategic communications and information warfare and so on and so on, they know these tactics. There's books and manuals that teach this to people in the United States military. I didn't make it up. I didn't make it up. Many people are trained in this. They know exactly what's going on. And why do they do that? Well, one, they're shaping the battlefields. Two, they're making it so that, you know, they're getting us accustomed to the idea. The blue wave in Texas was supposed to prepare us for them cheating and pushing Beto O'Rourke, a guy who's, you know, who isn't, by the way, even Hispanic, right? I've got to get my dog. Hold on. Come on. Sorry. Aww. She's upset. Come on, honey. No. Lie down. You know, a guy that is against gas, guns, and God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's making inroads in Texas. No, he's not. Okay. He's not. It's a lie. And they're preparing you because if they don't, when you hear that election result, nobody's going to believe it. So they've got to prepare you for it, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with Trump. You know, Biden never left his hole underground. Trump's all over the country with, you know, tens of thousands of people, rallies like you've never seen in your life before. And you're supposed to believe that Biden beat him. Like, before you even get to the evidence, some people, you know, they just are never going to accept that because they know in their heart, they know in their heart that's not how it works. Mm-hmm. And you can spin it away. You can get some, you know, I got to watch my language. You can get some idiot from, you know, to go on camera and say, from CISA and say, this is the most secure election in U.S. history. I mean, could you find a bigger lie? Just find anyone who worked for CISA who actually said that they did anything about any of the fraud and any of the reports that came in. I know they didn't. I know that, right? Because I got it firsthand from the people who witnessed what they were doing, how even before the election, they were burying any report of irregularities. They wouldn't even look into it. I mean, this gets my blood boiling because it's so fundamentally dishonest. And the people who are paying the highest price are the Ukrainian people. Mm. Right now, it's the Ukrainian people paying the highest price. But in the end, it will be all of us, right? It will be all of us. We will all pay that price because the people who are leading us to World War III, who are desperate to have some catastrophic attack or some major event, they're the people who are, you know, who Durham has in his sights as they march towards accountability. They're the people who are being exposed as the COVID lies fall apart. And we now see the number of vaccine injured and dead and so on and so on, and find out more about the treatments that they withheld and, you know, all of the things that they did to basically murder people around the world. Imagine when we, the people in every country, figure it out as they are doing and rise up. That's what they're afraid of. Yeah, right. So how convenient to say that Putin is the one going to drag us into a world war. I'm not saying Putin's Mother Teresa. Come on. You know, his record is very clear. Mm-hmm. But Putin may just be nice guy, bad guy. I mean, obviously, you know, to many people, especially the Russians who've been on the political opposition, have been on the receiving end of Putin's tactics. But he's still the guy standing between us and the lunatics that want, you know, global governing structures. Right. A new world order. The one that Joe Biden talks about, and then we pretend he didn't talk about it.
Right.
When his meds failed.
Yeah. And when you talk about that, the election and the medication and all this other stuff that seems to be going on, I pulled something up the other day, this guy, Jesse Kelly.
Oh, yeah. I love Jesse Kelly.
Yep. He said coronavirus was weaponized to make sure Donald Trump didn't win re-election and line the pockets of pharmaceutical companies.
And that's just two of the things, right?
Yep.
Because what else did it do? It didn't just line the pockets of pharmaceutical companies. It was a literal transfer of wealth from small businesses and small farms into the hands of the big corporations, right? Yep. Wasn't it $3 trillion or something? Yep. I mean, who made money during the pandemic? The Walmarts, right?
Yep. Yep.
The Amazons. Mm-hmm. These are all the people that made money, right? These are all the people that benefited from coronavirus. It was the small businesses. And by the way, you know, Victor Davis Hanson told me once that the one condition that has to be in place for, you know, Marxism and communism to take root is the eradication of the middle class, because you have to kill hope. People have to give up all hope that they can improve their life on their own, that they can go from, you know, lower class to middle class or to, you know, to being wealthy. The American dream has to be assassinated, obliterated. It has to be, you know, completely eradicated. And I, you know, I love Jesse Kelly, by the way, but where I diverge from Jesse, and I'm always sending him things to say, see, Jesse, this is what I mean, is I believe that they're using Marxist tactics and communist tactics, right? Because these are great tools to control people. And don't forget, they're tools to control the left, right? They control Antifa that way. They control the Marxists that way. But in the end, we're not heading for, you know, communist China. That's basically, you know, going to be like a dream compared to where we're headed. Because with technology, right, we're headed. In fact, James Palouse writes about this. He did a book, Human Forever, and he's testified on the Hill. That testimony is just spectacular. And what we're really heading towards is a technocracy, an autocratic technocracy, where you have a small number of people that control all of us. And our, you know, we're enslaved by the technology, right? Because they're going to be able to monitor every single thing that we do and so on and so on. I mean, there's a lot to it, and I won't digress too much.
Right.
But what did Jesse Kelly say in that, by the way?
Yeah. So anyway, I wanted to play this clip of exactly what you just said. You ready?
You know, we are at an inflection point, I believe, in the world economy. Not just the world economy, in the world. It occurs every three or four generations. As one of the top military people said to me in a secure meeting the other day, 60 million people died between 1900 and 1946. And since then, we established a liberal world order, and that hadn't happened in a long while. A lot of people dying, but nowhere near the chaos. And now is a time when things are shifting. There's going to be a new world order out there, and we've got to lead it. We've got to unite the rest of the free world in doing it. So anyway.
So what's your interpretation of that one?
Okay. Wow. This is another one that I need to breathe and find my patience.
Yes.
Okay. I can do it.
Come on now. So, get fired up.
There you have it, right? There you have it right in front of you. You know what it reminds me of, what they're doing here? It's very interesting. I'm glad you played that for me. Because here Biden says what they're doing, right? And he doesn't seem to be confused about it at all. He knows exactly what he's saying because they've medicated him. And actually, what they then did was walk it back. You know who else did that? Do you remember when Hillary Clinton in 2016 made her speech about deplorables? Remember when she listed homophobic, you know, Islamophobic, blah, 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 all of the deplorables. Mm-hmm. And then what did they do? They said, oh, no, you know, there was an outcry, right? And so they're like, oh, she didn't mean it. You know, she went too far. That wasn't what she meant, blah, blah, blah. And then what did they do for the next, I don't know how many years until right now, actually, they're still doing it. They then went after every single one of us with those labels. You're an Islamophobe. You're a homophobe.
Right.
You know, you're a misogynist. You're this, you're that. It wasn't a mistake, that speech. It was a list of targets. It was exactly, they were projecting and saying exactly what they were going to do.
Right.
They have spent every single minute of every single day since she made that speech painting anyone who is in opposition to them as one of those deplorables.
Mm.
So what I see here is the same tactic, right? This is exactly what they're doing now. They put it out there because that way, no intrepid, if there are any left, right? If there are any real journalists with a backbone left at the New York Times, for example, they're not going to stumble across this and figure it out for themselves and fight to get their story done because it's been laid out for us and now it's already been debunked, right?
That's right.
So they're not going to report it. What are they doing? They're making sure they know what's going to happen. They know that you and me and a whole bunch of other people who've reported on the New World Order, following their words, right, their plans, their actions, they know that we're going to jump on that. And so now this is their chance for their audience to say, oh, no, 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 that's not what's happening. And look at these lunatics, right? Look at these crazy people, crazy conservatives and crazy people on the right. Look at them all. And look what they've done. They've buried that narrative.
Yep.
So now reporters on, you know, at these places in mainstream media and whatever else, right? People that claim to be on the left or don't claim to be on the left, but are so obviously, propagandists for one ideology. It's not even on the left. It's a radical progressive New World Order ideology that doesn't even represent most liberals or most Democrats. It's not even theirs. But what are they doing? They're making sure that their own team or people who think they're on their team don't touch that narrative.
Right. That's right.
Because it's already been debunked. And you don't want to be one of those crazy right wingers, right? That's still talking about this. Come on. So it's very interesting, their tactics. But make no mistake, it is confirmation that that's exactly what we're dealing with.
That's right. That's right. And so I'm going to close out the show with something that we talked about before we hit the record button of the 50-50 that you shared with me earlier on what we can do. So we've got all this knowledge. We're playing it constantly. We're showing what they're up to. But one of the things that I try to do quite a bit on almost every single show that's released is try to bring something positive at the end so we don't just lose hope that these guys are controlling all of us and that's it. It's the end. We get stuff like this. Maybe the last drinksman, he said the media can't push the lies anymore. Thousands of digital soldiers dig up the facts in minutes and spread the truth within hours. Narratives that would last weeks are destroyed in days. We are the news. We are the storm.
Wow. You know what? Who posted that?
That's Last Drinks Man on Twitter.
Whoever that is, right? Because we don't know.
It's all anons, yep.
You know what? I just realized reading that. I see what they've done. You know, a lot of people wonder, is anybody fighting for us? Is there any leader out there? Is anybody going to save us? Is anybody going to do anything, right? You hear this all the time. And this idea of the digital soldiers has been around for a while now. And I didn't know exactly what it meant. But now I realize we're all digital soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it actually means. Yes, there are some digital soldiers who have been working on this, unrecognized, probably unpaid, nameless. And they've been working at great personal cost and sacrifice. And they are out there. But actually, what the real idea is behind it is that we're all digital soldiers. And this is so interesting because, you know, I sent you that clip of Anonymous, mm-hmm. right? And when you and I were talking about that before the show, that's when I realized it was that what it brought into focus was that as much as technology is being used against us, what they don't want us to remember is that we have that power too. Whatever technology can do for them, it can do for us.
Hmm.
Right? That's and right. So, and guess what? You don't have to have a permit to learn how to program. You don't have to have a gun license, right? Or do a background check to figure out the lies and to call them out on it.
Right.
You just have to have enough people that speak that language, that can decode it honestly, and who build those aircraft carriers, right? Those platforms like MAGAinfo.tv
mm-hmm.
That Jason Sullivan has built that cannot be taken down, that are not on the Amazon servers, that are not answerable to Google or, you know, Twitter or any of these other people. You just have to build them. Build those structures. This is what I say to people. I'm not here to tell you what to do and how to do it. It's not my job. It's not my place.
Yep.
But all I can say to you is you built this country. You built this country. Every one of you. It wasn't just them. Right?
Right.
So do what you do best, whatever that is. Mm. And that will be enough.
Yep.
That in the end will be enough. Just don't surrender.
Mm.
Don't give up. Don't give in. Don't let them break your spirit. Don't let them kill your hope. Don't buy into the deception, right? Yep.
Amen.
Open your heart. If you have an open heart and you have an open mind, you can figure it out. You'll know in your gut.
Yep.
You know when you're being lied to.
I want to end with this, and I hope that folks hear this loud and clear. Most of my listeners hold to this, but you had mentioned before we hit record that you do – hear from God when you're speaking, like in that speech you gave when you received that Emmy Award out of all the many that you've received, that there seems to be something speaking through you, and I feel it and I sense it, and we had a great time, and you helped me in a lot of ways and really broke me down, this old Marine. And so I'd just love to hear from you on your thoughts on that and how God has been supporting you, and then I'm going to close this in prayer, if that's okay.
Yes, that would be lovely, actually. And I want to be very clear that for me, I don't care what faith you are, whether you're, you know, Jewish or you're Muslim or you're Buddhist or you're Mormon, whoever you are, this is a moment. This is literally a moment, and all of us can feel it, where we have to choose, right? We have to know who we are. You are either with God or you're not. And I'm shocked, actually, at this point in my life to see how far we've traveled from that understanding and that place. When I think back on my own life, I was angry with God for a very long time. When I saw the suffering of people, when I saw injustice, I just couldn't reconcile it. It was very hard for me. I didn't know what to make of it. Mm. You know, I understood, I listened, I paid attention, and I just went, and I never stopped going. I never looked back. I just kept going forward. And what I learned, you know, after all these years, I mean, I've been a journalist now for 35 years, more than 35 years. I've survived things I shouldn't have survived. Mm. But I've learned things every single place that I've been. And I remember being in ancient Mesopotamia, what is now the north of Iraq, and asking the people in that village. This is a village where Jesus walked, like not, it's not a myth, you know, this is actually where Jesus walked those cobbled streets. And I wanted to understand, for so many years I've been in the Middle East and been in Israel and been in the Palestinian territories and been in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Jordan and so on and so on and so on. And I wanted to understand. So I asked, you know, you can ask how old something is and you get 400 different answers, believe it or not. The cultural thing. Yeah. Everybody's got a different answer. So eventually I said, take me to the oldest building. And they said, oh, no problem. Nobody had any arguments. Everybody in the village knew where the oldest building was. And they took me. You know where they took me, LT?
Yeah.
They took me. They didn't take me to the mosque, which you might expect.
Yeah.
They didn't take me to the church. They took me to the synagogue. Mm. And then I said, the next oldest building. And they took me to another synagogue. And then they took me to a church, right? Mm. And what I learned was that for 600 years, ancient Mesopotamia was a Christian place. Mm-hmm. Before that, it was a Jewish place. Mm-hmm. But the Assyrians were the first nation to convert as a nation to Christianity. And that was in the first century AD, right? And so for 600 years, there were no Muslims in northern Iraq.
Right.
They never set foot on that ground.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that they don't belong there.
Right.
It doesn't mean that's not Islamic, holy Islamic sacred ground today. Of course it is. It's just about trying to understand the truth. I had been in arguments with Israelis and with Palestinians and, you know, with all kinds of people about who owns what and who belongs there and who's got a right to it and who doesn't. Is it Al-Aqsa Mosque? Is it, you know, the Temple Mount and so on and so on. And I just wanted to understand and I just wanted to try to figure it out. And I say all of this to you because when I was standing in that church, the Assyrian church in that village just outside of Mosul, when ISIS had taken Mosul, I realized listening to the prayers in Aramaic that the language of Jesus would die and disappear with the death of these people if it wasn't remembered and it wasn't carried on. And although I wasn't a very good Christian, I understood that this was my home. I am still a Christian. And, you know, all these little pieces have fallen into place along the way. When I was working on my series on Big Tech, Big Brother for Fox Nation, you know, I realized, wow, I went into the Nevada desert and in the middle of nowhere you have all these massive, massive, massive data facilities. And they're under, you know, lock and key. They've got cameras and fences and this and that. I mean, security like you've never seen in your life.
Yeah.
And I realized not only is there not a cloud, right? Our information doesn't disappear. It doesn't vaporize.
Right.
Oh, no. It's right there. Every secret, right? Every thought, every picture, everything. It's right there. And it's so valuable to them. It's under lock and key. And what are they building? Massive water towers. Why? Because they need the water for the machines.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need it for us. They don't want us taking it. They want it for the machines because they keep our data cool in the Nevada desert, right? They've got to cool it at a certain temperature, and they need backups of backups of backups because they can't risk losing it. And what do they need to keep it cool? They need water. They need electricity. And I'm like, well, that's what they want it for. That's why we've been told that there's a shortage. There's no shortage of food. Why do we believe that eating protein chemicals created in a laboratory, in a factory, is healthier and better for us than eating meat?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we believe that? For how many years have humans survived on Earth without protein bars?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are we not in the age of organic is better? Yeah. Everything natural is better? Wait, except what's natural?
Mm.
So then you start to realize when you put these pieces together, you actually start to realize, wait a minute, there's no such thing as renewable energy. Solar power isn't renewable.
Mm-hmm.
If the sun doesn't shine, it's gone.
Yeah.
Wait, wind power, that's not renewable. The wind doesn't blow, it's gone, right?
Yeah.
And, oh, yeah, they're trying to work out ways to store it, but they can't really figure out ways to store it. And so what is truly renewable? You know, one of the worst things I learned was what Bill Gates has been doing with the Gates Foundation to the farmers in third world countries. It's reprehensible. It fills me with a real sense of disgust. Right? Because the Gates Foundation has gone all across the third world and they've said, oh, poor third world farmers, we're going to help you farm. We're going to help you. We're going to bring technology based farming. So you're bringing in technology that, cannot be repaired, cannot be maintained, you know, cannot be sustained by the farmers, right? So you're creating a dependency and you're telling them that you're helping them, but actually you're making them slaves. You're enslaving them because now they're going to be indebted to you forever, right? And then on top of that, you're saying, oh, guess what? You know, in return, what we need you to do is we need you to plant these GM modified seeds because they're better for you. Okay. So now never mind that they're from Monsanto and Bill Gates owns 70% of Monsanto. How about what happens to GM modified seeds at the end of the season, at the end of the harvest? You know what happens to them?
What happens?
They die. They're done. So guess what? You have to buy them again. So now you've gone from being a farmer who may not be able to farm efficiently, who may not be able to feed as many people. But guess what? He could grow food year after year after year. Because who created seeds that are renewable? Like truly, like who created life that is truly renewable? What is the only thing on earth that is actually renewable?
Mm.
It's life.
Yeah.
And they can, you know, go back to the Big Bang Theory and Darwin. I mean, when I found out, does anyone know who employed Darwin, where Darwinism comes from?
go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, look it up. Yeah. The Rothschilds.
Yeah.
It goes right back to 10 Downing Street.
All the way.
And the same people who employed Darwin. Mm-hmm. And that's when Darwin, you know, wrote his theory of evolution and so on and so on. And I'm not saying that none of that is true.
Right.
I'm just saying Darwin was hired by someone to come up with a theory.
Correct.
Right? Based on evidence. Okay, fine. But, you know, even the people, the scientists, all of the people that can take you back to the Big Bang, what is the one question they can never, ever, ever answer? They can never tell you whatever that was, whether it's the molecules or the energy or, you know, all that stuff. All these scientists like that, you know, that evil, horrible person who's the science advisor to Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum, who says there's no such thing as freedom. There's no such, you know, there's randomness, but that's not freedom and blah, blah, blah. There's probability and there's this and there's that.
Right.
They can explain it away any way you like. But how did those things come into being?
Yeah.
You know, and it was a combination of it's that question of what came first, the chicken or the egg, right? You can't answer that scientifically. You just can't, because something made that into being, whatever it was.
Yep.
And then when I really, that stumbling block that I had with God about suffering, it was really when I saw, when I finally understood that when you get told from the very beginning that free will, God gives us free will, and that doesn't mean anything to you.
Right.
Didn't mean a whole lot to me when I was young. Of course I have free will. What are you going to tell me what to do? No, you're not going to tell me what to do, you know, because that was my spirit. But I didn't understand that if you, I didn't understand what principles really were. Now I understand that principles are absolute. That's why Shakespeare is still relevant today, because the principles that are relevant, right? When the Spartans fought for freedom, they fought the same battle that we're fighting today. And how long ago was that? It was the beginning, right? Right from the very beginning. So principles, the problem with them is that you can't pick and choose when you're going to stand up for principles. My friend Jewel, the country music singer, said to me once, principles are not bumper stickers, right?
Right.
They, I mean, if you don't stand up for them when it counts, that's all they are. They're just bumper stickers. They're meaningless. They're just words. And the best example that I give people is, you know, growing up in South Africa under apartheid, there were people that were behind bars because of the color of their skin who didn't deserve to be there. There were people who were put to death because of the color of their skin. And so I knew I did not believe in the death penalty, right? Because I couldn't bear the loss of one life, one person being put to death for the color of their skin who didn't deserve it and who wasn't guilty. That to me was a greater injustice than when people would say to you, because if you're against the death penalty, the next question is, okay, well, what if your child was raped and murdered and tortured? Right. And wouldn't you want the people who did that to die? Yes, I would. I'd want to kill them with my bare hands. Mm. But guess what? If I believe in the principle, right? Because Nelson Mandela would be, he would have been dead if they'd hanged him for terrorism when he was convicted, right? You would have lost a person like that. And how many others? How many others did you lose? So for me, the principle was worth it. I would be prepared. I understood that there's sacrifice in principle, that you have to say, you know what? I'm going to want to kill those people myself, but I'm not going to do it. I'm going to have to live with what the law delivers. I'm going to have to live with, you know, with prison or, you know, whatever it happens to be, whatever that punishment is, because the principle of believing that we don't have the right to make that decision and take a life. Now, other people may not agree with that, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't have to. Yeah. It's something that I feel strongly about because of my beginnings in South Africa. Yeah. And I didn't want one black person in South Africa to die because of the color of their skin. Mm-hmm. I don't want one person to die anywhere for that reason.
Correct.
So for me, my commitment to these principles, this was a lifetime of building towards these things, right? So I understood that the principle of free will, if it's not absolute, it's not real. So when somebody decides to hurt someone, an innocent child who doesn't deserve to be hurt, if God intervenes and changes the outcome of that decision, it's no longer free will. And so as much as it pains me to accept that, I had to accept that free will is our gift. And it is the dividing line between God and the devil. That is the dividing line. Because all these people that seek to control you, it's how you know they come from a place of darkness. You know, they never tell you the truth. Hugo Chavez, he didn't get elected saying, I'm going to rob you blind. I'm going to impoverish this entire country. Right. I'm going to destroy everything you ever loved. And you're going to be so happy. No, you know, he didn't, right? That's not what they tell you.
Right.
They never come to you as who they are. They never stand in the light. They don't, they lie and they lie and they lie.
That's right.
And they come from a dark, dark place where they will tell you that what appears to be evil is not really evil. And what appears to be good is not really good, and so on and so on and so on.
That's right.
And so all of these things really brought me to a point where I had a real peace in understanding and accepting that we are created by something much bigger than us. And I know there are people out there who say, well, that doesn't mean it's necessarily God. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something else. Well, for me, it's God.
Yeah.
That's just what it is. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's any faith. It's people of faith. I have a, you know, I have a brother who's Muslim, and he's one of the people I love most in the entire world. He's one of my best friends. And I looked at him the other day because he's been a devout, Muslim all his life and all the time that I've known him, which is 20 years. And I said to him, Ahmed Shah, you were right. Because I used to tease him, right? Mm-hmm. And, as brother and sister, that kind of thing. And I looked at him and I said, you were right. You were right. And that's how I feel. I have no idea how I've survived this long. I go out on the stage. I do an interview. I do whatever. I don't have to write down what I'm going to say because right. When you tell the truth, you don't have to worry about it. When I was being investigated by, the CBS investigators after the Benghazi story blew up, my producer, Max McClellan, and I, we never worried. We never worried. We didn't have a single moment where we worried about what the other one was going to say because he knew I was going to tell the truth and I knew he was going to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And we knew that those two things were going to line up perfectly because there's only one truth. And that's exactly what happened. And we never fought about that. I mean, both of us lost things that mattered dearly to us in that moment, right? Things that we've never gotten back, things that have never been restored. And to this day, we have never had an argument about what happened. Never. Not one moment of doubt. And that's what the truth is. And for me, I understand that that truth comes from God. And I choose, and I've said this publicly, I choose God. I am not going to walk in the dark. I am not going to walk with evil. I am not going to do that. And I am so grateful. And I can truly tell you that accepting and understanding that has changed my life. Mm. I mean, I don't even know. These people come out of nowhere. And they come and they stand by me and they help me. I have people calling me that I've never met. And telling me, that little dog you saw, there was a woman who had a dream about me on Friday night. And she said, you had a small animal. She said, I think it was a small dog, but maybe it was a cat. I said, no, it's a little dog. It's Honey. She sleeps with me every night. And she said, you were holding on to her. And she's a hot dog dog, as we call it, a mini dasher. She's like a little person. And you can hold on to her like that. She loves it with her little head. My dog was giving me honey. My little honey.
Oh, look at that.
Hello, honey. Hello, honey. I know. How did she see? That woman saw this dog in my arms. How did she see that? How did she know that? Mm. Right? I mean, and this is what has been happening to me. There's people praying for me. Yep. And I got up on, what was it, Friday morning, and I knew. I had pointed out that the Black Sun of the Occult was on the uniforms of Ukrainian soldiers and that it was a Nazi SS symbol.
Yep.
And that, that Western Ukraine was the headquarters for the SS and that Western Ukraine had backed the Nazis. And they were invaded. Not all of them had a choice, right?
Right.
And that the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, had protected Ukraine's Nazis from the Nuremberg trials. And that the U.S. is arming and equipping Nazis in Ukraine while they're putting people in prisons and calling them Nazis in America for being parents or, that want to have a say in what their children are taught and so on and so on. They're not in prison, but they're criticized and cast as domestic terrorists, right, and being investigated. And I knew, I could feel that I was under attack. I didn't even know. I hadn't read the articles. I hadn't seen any of them. And so I asked all the people, all the prayer warriors out there, I asked them to pray for me because I wanted every evil person coming for me to be met by a wall of prayer.
Amen.
I wanted them to feel that.
Amen.
I wanted them to feel God's presence around me.
Is the verse that popped up for me for the verse of the day was Matthew 6:34. So here you are talking about all of this and you wrapped it up perfectly. It says, therefore, don't worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. And that came straight from Jesus' mouth. And you helped me quite a bit today before we started the recording.
You're going to take a rest, right?
Yes, about getting
rest. You're
going to
take a break?
And more.
And all of your people, all of your audience, they're going to back me?
Yep.
Because you need a break.
And
I'm holding you to it, LT.
Okay.
See what I did there?
So, yes.
I got you.
Yeah, and so it's just been wonderful, and I feel like I just felt like it was important for folks to know who you are, your foundation. I think we got that wrapped up pretty good. And
yes.
Because we see you all the time. I mean, you're all over the place. I mean, just search for you on DuckDuckGo, and you're just everywhere. And but it's mostly about what's breaking, the news, this, that, and the other. And so I just found it your story fabulous. And you weren't just overnight famous on DuckDuckGo or Google search, whatever. It took years of forming you. And I believe from God, right? Mm-hmm. He just chips away and creates this personality that just makes you so driven. And it's very magnetic, and I love it. And to be able to meet you and talk to you before this to help me in a lot of ways as a journalist and as a guy who's trying to take care of teenagers in the home and so mm-hmm. much more, I just want to thank you for this time. It means more to me than anybody out there will ever know. And so I want to close this in prayer.
Thank you.
Hopefully we'll be able to get together again sometime soon.
Oh, yeah, we're not done. We got a lot of work to do.
And I want to see, we definitely want to see what's going to become of you and the plan. You've got so many different ideas, and they're amazing. Maybe we can talk about those as they start coming to life.
I'm hoping I get Alex Trebek's job and I can go sit on the beach for a little bit of time.
Oh, that'd be great. All right. So I'm just going to end in prayer.
Okay.
And, let's just go to him. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for Lara Logan. The impact that she has made on this earth has been absolutely amazing. The people that she knows personally throughout so many different families, the people that she's touched, you know. You formed her in the womb before. You knew her before she was even in the womb. We've watched her grow. We've heard her stories. And we know that you have just been taking care of her and protecting her. We lift her up to you, as she says, to be protected by an army of prayer warriors. May she be surrounded by your guiding hand every second of every day. May you bless her beyond anything that she's ever seen before. We know in Scripture it says that you bless us by pressing down, shaken up, and flowing over. That's how you do things. We know it. We've seen it. We've seen everything that you've done in her life. And we just ask that you would continue to protect her, her family, and watch over everything that she does from this day forward. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Laura. It's been great. Hope to talk to you again soon. And
you will.
I'm really looking forward to it, okay?
Yeah. Luckenbach, Texas, with Waylon and Willie and the boys.
You
but good hands in Texas. That's a Rose of Texas. I again, thank you, LT, for the great interview. And Laura, you know, yes, our prayers are with you as well. We'll have you on the story behind the story shortly, if God wills on that. Oh, golly, what do you think? Long interview, James and Burak, but what's your thoughts? And we'll close out.
That was an amazing interview. I hope we can kind of let it stand. You know, she's right. There are Nazis in Ukraine. There's a ton of Nazis in Ukraine. And the U.S. Congress has even condemned Ukraine over it in the past. I think in 2015 or 16 they did that. And just like they condemned like QAnon and what have you, that it's meaningless, but it means they recognized it. So that happened. You know, there's other things that are happening right now that are super important as well, that this may be deflecting some from. Ketanji Brown Jackson, the justice that's been nominated for Supreme Court justice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She's being deflecting every answer on every important topic and subject. She's up there like a defendant in a murder trial. and it's what, and then she doesn't speak that well. You know, I don't speak that well either, but I'm like an Army trained speaker. I speak like people in the Army. That's me. You know, that's what I did. That's what I do now. I'm your basic sergeant. She's a justice up for a lifetime appointment as a Supreme Court justice to make the law, not make the law, to interpret the law for all of us all over the 50 states. And she's deflecting on every important issue. She won't tell them what she thinks because what she thinks is likely abominable, and most Americans will be distraught over her selection for it. And that's why that's not going on. So yeah, this is super important, what's going on in Ukraine. I personally am not taking sides on the government's issues. I think that the Ukrainian people need to be out there and be able to defend themselves, just like you would defend yourself in Utah, or I would defend myself in California, or Ron in Arizona, because that's what we do. That's the proper human thing. But I think that the Ukrainian government is corrupt and full of Nazis. You're right. And the Russian government is not that special either. So I'm not taking sides, because right. America has nothing, except for the fact that we won't be able to get caviar for a while. There's nothing else going on in Ukraine that has sort of bearing on the United States of America.
I liked what she had to say about the projecting what they really want with World War III. I concur 100% with that. Whether it's raising the specter of electromagnetic pulse to take out our power grid, whatever it may be, this is absolutely the most evil sources in the world. And you're right. It's the mainstream media is so corrupt. They're not bringing the main stories to bear at all. And the Supreme Court justice being a dark, dark individual. I'm not talking about skin color now. It's exactly the problem. And, you know, Kevin, you had something to say. Go ahead. We're running out of time rapidly, so.
Yeah, true. Radio chat.
Yeah, good. You're coming through great.
Hey, and, that, irrespective of the content, that has to be one of the best, longest interviews I've heard in such a long time. It was a dance.
Yeah.
The people who conducted that interview were so well prepared and expected everything. It was perfect. There's so much to learn, even without the content, how that interview was conducted. I think that it's one of those moments where everybody pulled off their microphones and their headsets, and can you imagine the feeling after something like that? I was deeply moved from that interview, and then of course Laura Logan, learned a lot about her that I didn't know.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you what it did for me, guys, is it gave me some real hope that we're not just alone here on an island. I've been kind of frustrated. There's every once in a while you get, you know, Joe Rogan or Stu Peters will be up. But man, I mean, the things that we have been saying on the show for years, I'm hearing brought out to her that she was right in our camp and doing the same things. And I said, well, if there's one Laura Logan, there's got to be others. And that really gave me hope that, you know, this battle can be waged. Like what she said about, we're all microphone warriors. We're tech warriors. We can turn the tide. We just have to know the power is within us. So
there are no snowflakes, Doctor. And the thing about it is, I recognized her voice after I heard her. I just didn't recognize her name. But there are no snowflakes. She's repeating things that we've been talking about for years online, and maybe she's one of the anonymous people in there talking with us. Who knows? That's the beauty of being anonymous on the internet, which is protected by the 4th and 14th Amendment, by the way.
Right. Well,
there's no doubt that she's a regular on one of your networks.
Okay. I'm sure, because I'm like, oh, I've heard that before. Oh, I've heard that before. It's like amazing.
Well, that's good. So, I mean, I want to just leave a quote that I had the presentation tonight. We'll do it next week. But this one, you know, it just really hit home. I thought we had to share it. Like and Alex would say, it's radio gold, as he would like to say so often. I think it's beyond that. It's radio platinum. It's a quote by Samuel Adams, who died in 1803, born in 1722. Those who forget our history, well, this is one of it. He's one of those, you know, unpopular patriot white Christians that are so out of vogue today. This is so apropos with what you just heard with Laura Logan. And Samuel says, concerning those who, the vast majority of people just want to protect their wealth, their they don't want to get involved. They want to stay on the sidelines and just let it go through. He said this, quote, if you love wealth more than liberty and the tranquility of your servitude better than the animating contest of freedom, well, depart from us in peace. Who is us? The movers and shakers, the founding fathers of this republic, this constitutional republic. Depart from us in peace. Samuel Adams said, we ask not your counsel nor your arms. Crouch down and lick the hand that feeds you. But may your chains rest lightly upon you. And may posterity ever forget that you were our countrymen.
Dr. Drew, that is exactly the sentiment of a lot of people, and especially in the EU when Justin Trudeau,
exactly,
went over there and just go to the Goldwater. I'm going to plug the goldwater.com, the aggregate section. We've got all of the video of all of the people, how his reception was and how normal, free, peace-loving people react to tyranny. Check that out. Back to you.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Okay. Yeah.
There are but two parties now, traitors and patriots. Ulysses Grant.
We really do have to go back to the very basics of what government is all about. I mean, Laura reemphasized that to me so well with just her witnessing the struggles for freedom, the principles, as she said. We got to stand on principles, but I'm here to tell you that I think especially this new class of millennials just don't understand the principles. They haven't been educated in the school system whatsoever, and they're sure not hearing it from the churches anymore. The principles of what is a constitutional republic and what it's all about and what the power, where the power comes from. It comes from God, not from man or not from a government. Those powers are rested in we, the people. It always has been, as always will be, no matter where you are in the world. That's the reality, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening tonight. This has been The Story Behind the Story. I've been your host, Dr. H. Roth. It's been a pleasure doing this show tonight. Thank you, guys. Again, Don, thanks for bringing that all in. We'll talk next week. Be well and be safe. Be well. Bye-bye.
Radio.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they a government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or you would be.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
Red, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution. Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time across the dimension.